6 a.m. on 720 WGM. Matt Bubala with you here till 5. Thanks for staying up later with us, everybody. We'll have Orion Samuelson with the morning show once we hit 5 a.m. Roger, my mom texted and yelled at me that... She texted me and said...
Why is she yelling?
Well, if you're not going to talk about the end of that Cleveland Browns game, then I guess I'll just go to bed. That's literally what she texted.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't... So we've got the one lady who we started the show with.
Right.
Says when you talk sports, I go away. Yeah. And then I got my own mother saying, well, if you're not talking sports, guess I'm out. Can't win.
Well, I guess you're going to have to do 5 minutes of sports.
Yeah, we will get to it later in the show. And I do want to talk more about Kristen Yelich. Now I'm getting mad at him the more I sit here and think about it.
Really?
Yes. What a jerk.
Yeah. Now, this was the quarterback? Milwaukee.
Well, huh? No. Kristen Yelich, the former MVP of the Brewers.
Oh, baseball. I'm sorry.
Tweeting at you, Darvish.
Right.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay, later.
Our old buddy Jason Steffen is on the phone live from Las Vegas. Speaking of Vegas, hey, Jason, how are you this morning?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. We just talked about Elvis for the last hour in his residency in Vegas, so it's a good tie-in for you to jump on.
Yeah, there's lots of them. We have lots of Elvises.
Do you have lots of Elvises? Have you, since you've been out in Las Vegas, have you and your wife stopped by a chapel and renewed your vows at one of the Elvis chapels or anything?
No, I can't say that we've done that.
Put that on your list.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm sure she'll love that. So, Jason, we haven't talked to you in a couple of years, buddy. We've talked to you lots over the years about your involvement with the Kepler mission to find habitable planets in other parts of our universe. And you guys are finding planets left and right all the time, right? I mean, has that search gotten any more... I know that the mission itself is over, but you have data for years and years and years to go through, and you're going to keep finding these planets. Has the research gotten any, or the technology, I guess, gotten any better that you can tell us any more about these planets other than they're within a Goldilocks zone?
So the main innovations that have happened lately is they were able to update the analysis pipeline, like the software that does the analysis, to make it so that there isn't the human element. So for most of the mission, people had to go through by eye and kind of verify the planets. And they developed an artificial intelligence thing that was, so they went through the catalog and were able to do a better characterization of all the systems. So that was a new, the latest development, and also the last development from the mission itself. I still work with the group of collaborators that I had in kind of understanding what we can get from just the discoveries. So that was kind of the end of the discovery phase, and now we're into now that we have all these data, what can we learn from them and what do they tell us about planets and planetary systems?
How many habitable planets have you guys found based on this mission?
The one that we're standing on, just Earth.
No, that's not true. Come on, we hear all the time that you found 8 more planets that could, I'm not saying that for sure have life, but fall within the Goldilocks zone of could sustain life. You guys have found, I thought, hundreds and thousands of them.
Probably not thousands. There are several dozen, like less than 100, but more than 50, that are in what we call the habitable zone. But the habitable zone is, I think, a little bit of a misnomer. It's a bit more complicated than what is portrayed. So what's claimed in the headlines is that these are within the habitable zone if you were to take the Earth and place it there. But if the Earth's atmosphere was a little bit thicker, then it wouldn't be habitable. If the Earth's rotation was oriented a little bit differently, then it wouldn't be habitable. If the moon wasn't there, it might not be habitable. And if we think in the solar system even about, like, where do people imagine looking for life in the solar system, there's Earth, Mars, Europa, the moon of Jupiter, and Titan, the moon of Saturn. 3 of the 4 places are not in the habitable zone that we would place around these other stars.
Interesting. Well, and that is a question I guess I would have, because whenever I read the headlines about, you know, 18 more planets found to be in blah, 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 then they'll describe the planets. They'll say, well, it's 8 times the size of Earth or this or that. And so you haven't found, I guess, are we sort of like hoping that somehow you guys find an Earth replica that's like the exact distance from its star and Earth-like size and things like that? Because I guess, you know, if a planet is four times the size of Earth, that's not really a planet that could sustain the life that we have, right? We wouldn't survive on something that large, correct?
Well, it would be a lot shorter. That's probably for sure.
Because gravity would be much stronger, right?
Yeah, gravity would be stronger. I think that the main issue, so the main, I guess, fundamental thing that the scientists are interested in is how many planets of a given size are there in a given, you know, range of orbital periods. And that's the question that Kepler originally set out to do. But there's some nuance in there that isn't all that interesting to the general public, and so we just say, okay, it's in the habitable zone. What we really want to understand is how common are Earth-sized planets in roughly one-year orbits around other stars, so that we can then kind of cross that off the list and go on to, okay, how many of those planets have atmospheres that look like the ones that we have? And so that's kind of the next generation of exoplanet missions, would be to characterize the atmospheres and know, get some better idea of what kind of chemistry is going on above the surface of those planets.
So if I ask you more specifically, how many planets have you found that are Earth-like in size and have roughly one-year orbits around their star? What do we reduce the number down to?
I think in that case, it's probably somewhere around 20.
And when you say Earth-like size, is it really Earth-like size, or is Earth-like size meaning not more than three times larger than Earth or three times smaller than Earth? What is the range of Earth-like?
So Earth-like is typically, so the main issue is rocky, whether that we imagine that it's a rocky planet or not. And so Earth size would go between about half the size of Earth up to maybe 1.5 times the size of Earth. Now that's the diameter, the mass. We don't have a good way to measure some of the masses of these planets because they're orbiting around stars that are so dim that it's hard to follow them up from the ground, but we can measure their sizes. And so basically between half the size of the Earth and 1.25, 1.5 times the size of the Earth is the range where someone would say it's a rocky Earth-like planet.
And if you and I were transported to a planet that was exactly the same otherwise, but 1.5 times the size of our current Earth, or half the size of our current Earth, how would that affect us?
The high jump would be a lot less interesting to watch.
Is that what it is? It's just all about the gravity?
Yeah, gravity would be the main difference. I mean, some other things could be different. For example, it's not clear that planets that are that massive would have plate tectonics the way that the Earth does, and so that would limit. So the Earth's climate is regulated through these long timescale cycles that can only happen when you have plate tectonics. And so these other planets, if they don't have plate tectonics, then they might not be able to regulate their atmospheric composition the same way that the Earth does. So that's one thing. What kind of magnetic fields might they have? These are all questions that are relevant to those, to planets that are that much bigger than the Earth, but yeah, still rocky.
So while we might not be able to have human-like life on other planets, we don't have to have perfection on another planet just to have life, and that would be enough for us to get excited about, would it? Just like bacterial life or anything that was life on other planets, would that get us very excited to say, hey, now we know that it does exist in some form elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that anything that looks remotely like any life that happens on the Earth, so even just like a strand of DNA or something like that, would be a major discovery.
I imagine even vegetation would be thrilling, right? Just to see that there was a planet that had trees?
Yeah, anything like that. Vegetation, to be honest, even discovering like an atmosphere that had a lot of oxygen in it, mm-hmm. Because oxygen, if all the life on the Earth were to die, the oxygen in the atmosphere would go away as well. So that the oxygen that's in the atmosphere now is produced by the life that exists on the surface.
That's so interesting. Okay, so I didn't bring you on to talk about that, although I'm excited to hear about this again and get reinvigorated and excited. Every time,
well, there is a new mission that's going on right now, too.
Okay.
So the test mission's flying right now.
So tell me about that.
So it's kind of a successor to Kepler, except it's looking at stars that are closer to the Earth. And so Kepler looked in a single direction, and so it has to find stars that are relatively far away in order to get a large sample. The test mission, which is about halfway through its mission, is looking, it does an all-sky survey, so it looks everywhere in the sky. And it's going to be finding planets around stars that are about 100 times brighter than the ones that Kepler found. And so those are the ones where we'll be able to do these atmospheric characterizations and things like that.
So then if you find planets in habitable zones, you'll get to learn a lot more about them.
Right. And we needed Kepler to know kind of what to expect with this mission, so we knew kind of how to design a mission like this.
Okay.
And so it's kind of the next step in the along the way of, you know, finding Earth 2.1.
Well, I've asked you this, I think, every single time you've been on the radio with me, Jason, and I'm not going to stop today, and that is, I'm assuming I got about 40 to 50 years left on this planet, if I do well, and I want to know that we will have confirmed life in other parts of our universe before I die. What's your prediction on that?
Not likely.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, dude, that is disappointing.
I'm still as pessimistic as ever on that one.
Because you don't know that it exists, or you think we're just not going to have the technology to make it happen?
I think it's a technology question.
Yeah. You think it's out there, though?
I think it's out there.
Okay. And do you think it's visited us?
Not likely. Although I haven't been able to get into Area 51, despite the fact that it's not that far north of me.
You didn't run out there when they were going to storm the castle that day?
No, I did not participate in that event.
That's a shame. All right, so here I have to claim my, I mean, not that I've ever claimed to be smart on anything at all. However, I'm feeling extra special dumb today, Jason, because I sent you an article that was printed in was businessinsider.com. I don't know why them, but they did a story about Interstellar, the movie that had come out 5 years before, and talked about how it was the most realistic depiction ever at the time of a black hole. Now, I saw the movie. I don't even remember the black hole part. I don't know why. But here's what happened. I'm reading this, and I'm realizing that here's the picture in my head that I've had for all of my 47 and a half years of a black hole. Like a hole in your backyard. Like something black, and things fall in, and they don't come out. And I've literally, my whole life, thought of a black hole as like a hole in the sky somewhere that things just get sucked into, and we don't know what happens. And it wasn't until I read this article that I read it, and then I'm like, wait a minute. So a black hole is not a hole at all. It's actually a mass, and actually a very powerful, very dense mass. It's basically like an anti-sun, I like to call it now, because it's so big and powerful and so dense and spins so fast. It just sucks everything in, not to a hole, but into a planet-like object itself. Is that more accurate than what I previously had pictured?
Well, it's both, actually. I think your first picture is probably a bit closer to the truth. The main thing is, so black holes form from, well, okay, most black holes probably form from the collapse of large stars.
Okay.
And while the star itself gets very, you know, the remnant star gets very dense and therefore, you know, has a lot of gravity, the hole that people refer to is the imaginary line surrounding this dense object where the escape speed, so the speed that you'd have to travel in order to escape from the surface, is faster than the speed of light. And so there is essentially a hole in space-time, like a hole in the universe, where things can go in, but things can't come back out. But that hole, like what you would call the surface of the hole, is not the physical object itself. The physical object itself, we don't know what size it is, so the assumption is that it's a single point. I'm not sure how... there may be something else going on inside the event horizon, which is the imaginary line where the escape speed is faster than the speed of light. So there may be something else going on inside there. We just don't know what it is, and we don't have a way to find out what it is either. So if you were to jump into a black hole, so you jump in, you get to experience gravity for the first time in your life, and also the last time in your life, and then you cross the event horizon, you might see something, but you wouldn't be able to tell anyone about it.
Okay, so now I'm really a mess. So I had it right. There is this massive object. However, the hole we're referring to is the point at which if you got too close, you would just go sucked right into it. that sort of this imaginary hole, right? That I know you're saying the where the speed is faster than blah, 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 but if I'm just the dummy next door that you're going to explain this to, basically there's this thing, and if you get too close to it, you're just getting sucked into it, and that's the hole itself, the point where you would where its power would overtake you and suck you right in.
Well, so I would look at it like this: suppose that you have like a drain in a sink.
Okay.
And the, you know, you'll form the whirlpool that forms isn't really the important thing, but you know, you're going to form this region where water is going to drain out of the sink. And if you're in a boat, okay, so it's a very big sink with a boat in it, and you're in the boat. Mm-hmm. So pretend there's a lake with a hole in the bottom, and the lake is draining out, and you're in a boat. The region around the drain where the water is moving into the drain faster than you can row away from it, that would be the surface of the black hole.
That's the black hole. And then the drain itself is not some hole that we're going to come out the other side. It's a mass, though, right?
Right. It's a mass. And that drain, the drain could be very small. It's just the region where you can't escape from. That is what we view as the black hole. Another misconception, so I hate to pile on this one, but black holes don't actually suck. They're not vacuum cleaners. They're basically, if you were to replace the sun with a black hole, the only thing that would change on the Earth is it would get cold. So the black hole acts like any kind of gravitating object. It's just if you're moving towards it, once you cross that event horizon, which is that imaginary surface,
Yeah. There's
no coming back out.
Because you're going to get sucked in and destroyed and crushed because it's
right.
So it's not actually sucking things in from all directions.
It's not a vacuum cleaner. It's just
if you get too close, like a handsy guy at a nightclub, you enter that and you're going to get touched.
And it gets overboard. Yep.
Okay.
And then
so if we replace the sun with a black hole right now, are we not close enough that we would? How close is the event horizon to a black hole?
So if you were to take the sun and squish it down to the size of, I think it's about a golf ball, you would get a black hole. Wait, hold on, is that right? So the event horizon that you would get from the sun, I think, is 3 kilometers. So if you were to take the sun and squish it down until it was smaller than 3 kilometers, that would be the size of the black hole. So in order to experience all the joys of falling to your doom inside this black hole, you would have to get within 3 kilometers of the center of the sun.
But and the sun would be the size of a golf ball at this point?
So I misspoke on that one. I haven't done the calculation for quite a while, but I believe that the event horizon, I can look it up, but I believe the event horizon size of a solar mass object is 3 kilometers. So if you were to take the sun and squish it down until it was 3 kilometers in radius, it would form a black hole.
Okay.
So replacing the sun with a solar mass object that's 3 kilometers in diameter, we're so far away from that we wouldn't experience anything. In fact, Mercury does experience some of the distortion of space-time. I mean, we do too, but we can't measure it. Mercury experiences some of the distortion of space-time due to Einstein's theory. But the amount that it feels is so tiny. It's like it moves by a tiny fraction of a degree. Its orbit changes direction by a tiny fraction of a degree every century is the effect that Mercury feels. And so you would have to get really close to the sun and squish the sun down to a really small object in order to see a lot of the weird stuff that is described in science fiction.
Okay, so the sun is now 3 kilometers in width, and that is just under 2 miles. So it's incredibly tiny, and how close would I have to be to it to get to the event horizon? Would I be just a mile away from it? Would I be a million miles away from it?
No, just like right next to it,
you'd
like 3 kilometers.
Right, you'd have to. So a black hole, you really got to get close to it to get sucked in.
Yeah, so you would experience, you'd start to experience increasingly weird phenomena as you got closer to it, but you'd still have to be, 10, 15, 20 kilometers away before some of the strange stuff really started happening. Like there's a region around a black hole called the ergosphere, mm-hmm. Where the space-time itself gets kind of twisted up. And as a consequence, if you were stuck in the ergosphere, your body would start to stretch out and kind of orbit around at different rates. Like your feet would stretch up and you'd kind of wrap yourself around the black hole.
All right.
That'd be pretty cool.
Now this is getting back to where I've learned about the black holes on The Simpsons. So, Jason, hold on for a second. We got to take a quick break. We got to do the news. We have more black hole talk. And as a special extra bonus, everybody, we're going to talk with Jason about the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's not related to black holes, but it's part of Jason's life that's pretty interesting. Lots to do. Stay with us here on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bobala with you here, 3:35 in the morning on 720 WGN. We're live in our show Skyline studio. I want to say Showcase studio, but that's a couple of years ago. On the 18th floor on Wacker Drive, overlooking Chicago and the river. It's a beautiful night here in Chicago. Beautiful morning. Jason Steffen, our friend from the Kepler Mission and a professor at UNLV. What's your official title out there, Jason?
I'm assistant professor in physics.
When do you get a professorship? When do you become tenured? When can you say
whatever
you want?
When I get the whole meal deal. Yeah. So I go up for tenure next year.
Nice.
Should be great.
You're looking forward to that?
I'm looking forward to it being over so that then I can kick back and, you know, waste the rest of my career.
He's kidding, everybody. Maybe.
No, we have a lot of stuff going on. I have several graduate students, a couple postdocs working with me and teaching several classes.
Is exoplanets kind of the career for you, or will there be other things you're trying to strive to start researching?
So exoplanets is kind of certainly for the near future. I am interested in possibly getting involved in molten salt nuclear technologies. So it's a generation 4 nuclear reactors that don't produce the same kind of waste, and they're more efficient, and they're less expensive, and they're way safer. And But I haven't found an inroad into that yet. That would probably have to take a sabbatical to ramp up on that one.
Explain to me again. What did you just say? Molten atomic what?
Okay, so the next generation of nuclear reactors. So most of the nuclear reactors that we have in the United States are called Generation 3. They're relatively old. The technology is kind of old, and you run into issues with, you know, how efficiently can you use the fuel, and you have safety issues in terms of, there's a lot of safety systems that go into manufacturing them that make them expensive. The next generation of reactors, they're called Generation 4 reactors. They're much more fuel efficient in that you don't produce quite the same amount of nuclear waste. They operate at higher temperatures, so they operate more efficiently. You can make them smaller. You can do a lot of industrial processes that consume a lot of energy that right now is typically done with natural gas. You can use the residual heat from the nuclear reactors to run some of those processes, like fertilizer manufacturing and things like that. So they're pretty promising technologies for cleaning up the power grid.
Well, that's really interesting to me because I would have thought that we're moving, you know, with all the wind turbines and solar technology and everything else, I would have assumed we were fully moving away from nuclear. But you think nuclear will make a comeback?
I think a personal opinion is, and it's actually shared by most of the physicists in the country, a similar fraction of physicists is the fraction of the fraction of climate scientists who say that global warming is an important thing, is roughly the same fraction of physicists who think that nuclear energy is the solution to the problem.
Wait a minute. Did you just say that there's only a fraction of people who think global climate change is a real thing?
No. So like climate scientists, it's like 90-95% of climate scientists think that global warming is a major issue, and I agree. And it's basically 90-95% of physicists and engineers that think that nuclear power is the solution.
Really?
Interesting. Yeah.
Because it's just more, well, there's a whole other topic, I guess, for another night. But so the nuclear waste would be much, because that's the biggest concern, is we have all these rods all over and we can't figure out what to do with them, and they're going to be there for 10,000 years before, right? So isn't that the biggest issue facing nuclear, plus the danger?
Yeah, so it with the nuclear energy, there's some isotopes, the ones that are heavier than uranium, so they're called transuranics. Those are the ones that have the 10,000-year half-life. The next generation reactor, you can actually the way that they're designed, you can actually extract those ones from the waste so that instead of having the long-lived waste kind of distributed in the spent fuel rods, you can pull those out, and then the lethal waste that will last for that long, and it's not the lethal waste, but it's the long-lived waste, you can concentrate down to something that's like 1/100th the size. And then the rest of the stuff, you store it for 100 years or something like that, and it's done.
Interesting. Okay.
So there's actually a professor at the University of Illinois that has a series of videos on it. And it's not like solar and wind are going to go away. Those are important technologies as well. But if you want something that's really going to sustain the country, and especially the world, because it's the United States only has a quarter of the greenhouse gas emissions, which, okay, it's a lot. But China actually has more greenhouse gas emissions than the United States. India is ramping up. And so you have to have a solution that works everywhere else in the world as well.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, we'll talk more about that another time. So back to black holes. And I was reading... I'm reading in this story that this supermassive black hole that we got a picture of...
Mm-hmm.
The unprecedented photo shows the supermassive black hole at the center of the Messier 87 galaxy, which is about 54 million light years away from Earth. The black hole's mass is equivalent to 6.5 billion suns.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
So does that mean it's that big, or that the mass, because it's a very dense object, right? Because that's the whole thing about a black hole is super dense, which makes the gravity so strong and the spin rate, and et cetera, et cetera. So are black holes ginormous things? Would a black hole, you said for a sun to be a black hole, we'd have to squeeze it down to less than 2 miles in circumference compared to what it is now. But are most black holes actually really ginormous things?
So we don't actually know what the distribution of black hole sizes are. The ones that we detect with the gravitational radiation observatories, like LIGO, and so the thing that won the Nobel Prize a few years ago, or maybe last year, with the discovery of these in-spiraling black holes from the big interferometer observatories that exist around the world, three of them that exist around the world. So those ones are like 10 to 60 solar masses each. These ones at the centers of galaxies, those ones are millions to billions of solar masses. So the one in the center of our galaxy is about 2.5 million solar masses. The one in M87 is 6.5 billion solar masses. So those aren't the most common, but they're definitely the largest. And so we actually did this in my physics class. This was one of the homework one of the exam problems that the students were given, was to figure out how big the event horizon is around these black holes.
So is there a black hole at the center of every galaxy?
It looks that way. It looks as though the center of any galaxy that's like the size of the Milky Way galaxy and bigger has a supermassive black hole.
And is this supermassive black hole what keeps the galaxy together? What, everything spins around that in some way, shape, or form?
Not really. So if you were to say, like, how far away from the black hole do you need to get before the mass that's interior to you? So you start at the black hole, you start moving your way out. It's the biggest fish in the pond when you're right next to it, that's for sure. As you start moving out, how far out do you need to go before the stars actually start? You have more mass in stars than you do in the black hole? And the answer is not that far. Once you get out, maybe 1,000 light years or something like that, then there's more material in stars and dark matter than there is in the black hole itself. And so while it dominates its local environment and it's the largest single object in the galaxy, it's not actually driving everything.
Interesting. But are we all spinning around it? I mean, it is the center of the galaxy.
Right. It is the center of the galaxy, and we orbit around it mostly because the center of the galaxy is where everything else is as well. It's like saying, it would be like saying that all of Chicago is centered around the Willis Tower.
Okay. It just
so the Willis Tower is the biggest single building, but it's not really the thing that makes Chicago work.
Okay.
The thing that makes Chicago work is the hot dogs. Which we don't have here in Las Vegas.
You don't have hot dogs at all, or you just don't have good Chicago dogs? Isn't there a
We don't have good Chicago dogs here.
There's not a
They're terrible, and they put ketchup on it and everything.
There's not a Portillo's in Vegas yet?
No, there's not, but I would love to open a franchise.
Yeah, well, they've got it in Phoenix now. I bet it's not far away.
Yeah, they have it in, there's some in California, too, but life's too short to go to California.
You do have In-N-Out Burger. Do you like a good In-N-Out Burger?
I can't say that it's all it's cracked up to
really?
Be.
Really? Okay. All right. That's fair. I have a, so first of all, I say habitable planets, and a texter, Ernie, yells at me that I'm saying that wrong every time. How do I say that? How should I be saying that word?
Habitable.
Habitable. Okay.
Yeah.
773 says, I have a question for your guest. Does he agree with Stephen Hawking saying that our planet has only about 100 years left to survive?
No.
Did Stephen Hawking really say that?
He may have. I don't know.
But you disagree?
I disagree.
Okay. Good deal. So, a black hole. Did you see the movie Interstellar?
No, I can't say that I did.
How do you not watch movies about what you do?
If I'm going to waste a couple hours and $10, it's going to be on a video game, probably.
All right, fair enough.
So the last movie I watched was probably like Moana.
Oh, children do that too. So do you avoid any entertainment culture reference to what you do because you know it's just not going to be good, or like a movie like Contact or things like that? Will you go see if you're so inclined?
It's not really my cup of tea in terms of leisure time. Like, I don't read popular science books either. Most of the books that I read are history books and war.
Okay.
You know, war history and stuff like that. And so I did read Neil deGrasse Tyson's book, I think. And I read one of Hawking's books, but it's not really something that I get into because I'm not really the audience that they're written for.
Yeah. So you just feel like, oh, boy, I knew all this already?
Well, it's not really. It's just, it's not as entertaining to me as it is, as some of these other things are. Because I do it every day, so.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. We got to take a quick break, but then I want to talk to you for a few more minutes about the fall of the Berlin Wall. As I was emailing you, you're like, hey, did you know, that story was last week, but did you talk about that? I was like, well, that's really odd for you, Jason, to bring that up because, no, I didn't talk about it. And why in the world would you and I talk about that? But you've got an interesting story about that. Jason Steffen, hold on one second, our assistant professor out at UNLV who studies exoplanets, has an interesting family relationship to what happened with the fall of the Berlin Wall. We'll talk about that real quick here on 720 WGN. It's 3:51 in the morning. We got the news coming up at the top of the hour. A few more minutes with our friend Jason Steffen from UNLV and the Kepler mission. Jason, you had asked me about the fall of the Berlin Wall. I think it was 30 years ago last week when the headlines were out about that. And why was that something you brought up to me? What's your relationship to the fall of the Berlin Wall?
Mostly just the historical significance of it. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, came of age in the 80s, where we watched all the communist paranoia films, Red Dawn. Things like that.
Wolverine!
And war games and some of my family, like in my family history, if you go back far enough, came from Silesia, which is now part of Poland.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was always told when I was young that, you know, we'd never be able to go to different parts of the world. We'd never get past the Iron Curtain because I was like, who has this Iron Curtain and what does it mean? And so just hearing that for the first 14 years of my life, and then the summer of 1989 is when Czechoslovakia opened its borders and people started flooding across. And then when I remember the day that the Berlin Wall fell. We talked about it in my world history class and we watched it on the news at home, and it was a big deal at the time. And to me it didn't get a whole lot of coverage despite how significant it was. You know, maybe it's because I wasn't really watching the news on the day, but you mean earlier this week, but
yeah.
It was you know, looking at the news reports, I was like, I remember where I was sitting when I saw this.
That's so fascinating to me. I was a senior, so it was 30 years ago last week, so 89, fall of 89, so I was a senior in high school. I don't remember it at all. I mean, I remember the video on the news of people, like, tearing down the wall. I remember that, but I could be remembering that more from just all the times it's been played over the years. But it's so funny how it just doesn't stick out in my mind at all. But your family had hoped to travel to Eastern Europe, and there was a time that your family thought that'll never happen.
Yeah, and so that was kind of what I expected. I expected that it would be, you know, 100 years before anything were to happen, and it didn't. It fell right over that one summer. Just there was so much change in Eastern Europe, and now, you know, I have colleagues that are from all over the place.
Yeah.
The guy that's two doors down from me in the physics department is from Poland. And so, you know, his life is definitely different, because he's basically the same age that I am. He grew up, you know, he spent his whole teenage years under communism.
That's pretty interesting. So,
and
so
then
I imagine
my own son is like in exactly the same classes. My own son is in the same classes that that I was taking at the time that this came down. I missed your question.
That's okay. So I imagine you've talked to that colleague about his life growing up and related to that and how different his life is now because of the opening up of everything?
Well, he's certainly happy to be here. I will, you know, now that this is, you know, I just kind of realized what time it was in terms of, like, when this happened. And so I plan to talk to him next week when everyone gets back into the office.
Real quick, before we let you go, we have a couple of listeners who have questions for you. I'm going to try to get through them real quick here because we got to take a break before the news. Mary, you're on 720 WGN. What would you like to ask Jason?
Oh, real quick, although if he's watching Manoah the cartoon, maybe he didn't watch this. How about Chernobyl on HBO, please? Did you watch it?
I haven't watched that, but I have watched a number of things that described all of the stuff that happened, kind of the way that they tested the safety systems and shut everything off that they weren't supposed to do, and they, like, all the things that they did wrong in order to have that happen. One of the main differences between reactors that were built everywhere else in the world and the reactor that was built in Chernobyl is that Chernobyl didn't have a containment building. And so once it went, there was nothing to hold. Basically, the nuclear reactor that was built there is kind of like a pressure cooker. And all of the reactors in the United States have these domes, big concrete domes that cover the reactor core, so that if the reactor core does go and you have a steam explosion, because it's the steam that comes out, it's not a bomb, it's basically the steam that leaks out. They have a containment building that prevents it from leaking out into the environment, where with Chernobyl, they had no containment building, and so it just, like, went straight out and caused the problems. But it's basically, Chernobyl's main issue was essentially a chemical fire.
Mm. And with the new Gen 4s that you were talking about, do you worry, because you said they get smaller and all these great things that are beneficial to it, but we worry a lot about other countries getting access to nuclear technology and what could be done with that. Is that going to be a concern with the Gen 4s?
No. So with these ones, there's no nuclear proliferation issue because you don't produce the fuel that you can turn into a bomb. For example, most of them run off of thorium, and thorium doesn't produce uranium-235. It burns through uranium-230. You start with thorium, it turns into uranium-233. You use that up for the most part. Like 85% of the material that gets burned is the uranium-233, and then the uranium-235 that gets produced also gets spent. And so there's nothing that comes out of it that you can really turn into a bomb. And the densities of stuff that you produce, in terms of, like, how much you actually produce, is like not even close to what you would need to do. To make a bomb, you have to have a pretty high concentration of the uranium-235. And most of these plants operate at like 20%, which is like a fifth of what you need, or like a quarter of what you need. It's really expensive to deplete uranium, or to enrich uranium to that extent.
Jason Steffen is our friend, assistant professor at UNLV, and a member, or a researcher on the Kepler mission, a fan of Eastern Europe and Gen 4 nuclear reactors. We've learned a lot about you tonight, Jason. I really appreciate you jumping on the phone with us. It's been too long. We'll do it again sometime soon, okay?
All right, sounds great.
All right, Jason Steffen, thank you so much. News coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN.